Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 274 for comics originally released on November 7th, 2012. Now, starting us off in DC is Ferris number 9. This is, of course, through the Vertigo label. This is the companion title to Fables. And before we start talking about this individual issue, I've got to say that I really think Fables is probably the most impressive narrative universe to come out of Vertigo. I mean, they've had some other great titles, don't get me wrong, but I think few have had their own kind of narrative, self-contained almost narrative universe. It's, you know, not stuff that's spilled out of DC or whatever. These characters obviously came from various Fables and whatnot, but I think within the Fables series itself, within Ferrest, within the Literals miniseries, certainly Jack of Fables, the amount of development we've gotten of this universe is just astounding. And of course, with this Ferrest title, we're getting to see some stories that fall outside of kind of the main narrative thread of the Fables series, and that has been, I mean, it's told different stories and stuff, but it's had a definite through line and progression since that thing started, you know, 125 or so issues ago. And I really like how, with this title, Willingham is acting as a consultant on this, so we can be assured that, you know, the stories we're getting here and kind of his vision of the Fables universe are in alignment. And it helps keep the same tone, style, and sensibility in this title that we get in Fables. You know, and here we're focusing on Rapunzel and her past. We get Jack of Fables, who's, I mean, he's in the story, but at this point hadn't really played a major role in it yet. And, you know, this is one of those cases where I like getting a second title for the Fables series. You know, there are a couple of other titles where they spin a second one off, and it's like, really, did you need to? And the twist here of it being the Ferris, the female Fables and stuff getting the spotlight here, has really been working well for me. I mean, I'm really enjoying this series. And this issue was no exception. You know, it told some good stuff. As usual, there was a fair amount of story in this issue. You know, it was a middle chapter, but, you know, it was very accessible. I don't think you really needed to have memorized the previous issue or even necessarily have read it, but go in expecting that, you know, we're going to start kind of in the middle of some stuff, we're going to end kind of in the middle of stuff, as is the nature of a middle chapter. But even so, I was pleased with what we got in this issue. I mean, what were your thoughts?
I didn't think this one was as accessible as other ones, mostly because it's dealing with a lot of Japanese fables that I'm not that familiar with. I mean, the things that I am familiar with, I like picked up from Usagi Yojimbo. You know, I think they have a lot of regular fable stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm at least familiar with most of the fables. They have like little nuggets here and there, and it's like, oh, I recognize who that is. It's not a knock against, you know, the writing or anything. It's just, you know, personally, I read through this and there were a lot of things going on that, you know, it's kind of like I didn't know what the heck they were on about. And they were using shorthand that were a lot of fables that I was just not familiar with. It's not a detriment to the writing. It's just a detriment to my familiarity with a lot of those fables. And just for me, it took a little bit away from the story. But I don't know that there's any way to fix that, you know, because you can't really, you know, because they don't do it in any other, in the regular Fables books, they don't beat you over the head with who these characters are. So if they suddenly started doing that, that would be bad too.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I know what you're talking about with the Japanese aspect of it. I was thinking accessibility in terms of, you know, Rapunzel and the Fables aspect of it. But you're right, this is diving into a different library of fables, a bunch of different characters, and frankly, a lot of the issues, cultural aspects of the Japanese part and stuff, for certainly myself as well. There were a few places where it's like, you know, I was kind of afraid that between this and 47 Ronin, which is also a Japanese story, that I was gonna, you know, feel a little wanting in certain aspects of just the cultural perspective. And I felt there were a few places here and there where that was the case, but to me, it was not a major factor in this issue. But I agree that would be one of the places they could have really strengthened it some.
I think it was more a factor because they kept jumping back and forth in time in this issue.
Yeah, and that was something that did kind of annoy me a little. It's like, okay, which time frame are we in? Okay, we're back, you know, X years ago, now we're back to the present. It's
if they had stayed in the present day and had, you know, the aspects, I enjoyed the present day aspects of the story more because I just kind of went with the flow, and it's like, okay, I know who this set of characters are, and then they're interacting with this other set, and just kind of went through the story. But then when they would flip back, and, you know, interesting, we'll talk more about it in 47 Ronin in a while, but I didn't really have that feeling of, I don't know what's going on when those guys tell the story, and they're telling the story with the Japanese culture and everything, and they don't beat you over the head with it or anything, but it's just, I never feel that sense of being lost in what the heck is going on when I'm reading a Usagi story. And I didn't feel that way when I read 47 Ronin, but I did feel that way when I read the flashback parts of this story. And I don't know why.
One of the key differences is in Usagi and in 47 Ronin, they've got kind of the footnotes in a couple of key places.
Yeah.
You know, this term means he's a landowner, gives this, here's, you know, that kind of stuff. And here they're not doing that. And it's interesting because, you know, when I watch the fan translations and stuff of some of the Sentai shows, there are places where not only do they have the subtitles, they have a, you know, this is a play on words of these couple of words or whatever to make the names of the monsters kind of explain those, or, you know, other, Japanese either idioms or historical aspects that they know a North American audience, just, you know, or an English speaking audience wouldn't get. And you're right. I mean, that is something that if they could have found a way to put that into this issue and feel natural, would have benefited it. But I also agree with you that it would have been difficult for them to do that because it's not something they've really had to do in the past, because most of us are familiar with, you know, Rapunzel, you know, Jack and the Beanstalk and the main fable characters. Now, if they'd had a history of kind of going through and explaining, and this is where this guy is from, then it wouldn't have felt odd now, but, you know, might have been an issue the entire time through.
Right. And it didn't particularly take away from the issue for me that much. I mean, it's just something to point out, right? I mean, I didn't say, oh, because of that, I hated the issue or anything. I mean, it was still a 4 out of 5. It was a solid issue. I thought that the last issue, I didn't feel that sense of being lost, but of course they weren't in Japan yet. And I don't, you know, it just read a little better for me. And, you know, this is a second chapter of a story. If I read this just in the context of, you know, the entire trade paperback that'll come out, I don't think it would have bothered me that much.
Yeah. No, I can see that. For me, it was definitely a 4 out of 5. The art on this was really good. And again, I enjoyed just how much story we get here. So, fun stuff. Definitely recommend this. If you're not familiar with the Fables, you know, universe, pick up the first trade. I think if you read the first trade, certainly by the time you read the second, if you're not hooked at that point, it's probably just not for you. I got into the Fables stuff late in the game. I think it was up to around issue 48 or something. And I picked up that first trade, really enjoyed it, and said, okay, let's go forward with this. You know, I was lucky to grab, I think the first 40 or 50 issues off eBay in one shot, so that was able to kind of jumpstart me onto that title, and I've been loving it ever since.
Yeah, it was a good book, good story, though. I've been enjoying it. So, next up, we've got the reboot of, well, not even reboot, just new number one, let's say, of Iron Man number one from Marvel. Now, this one, the main thing here that was a little strange to me was, so we just reviewed the last issue of the previous Iron Man series the week before last.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago.
I think it was. And, you know, so at the end of that, Iron Man's flying off into space to be in the Guardians of the Galaxy series, I believe. And now this one just seems to be, okay, now let's take a step back, and we've got just regular Tony Stark wandering around. So, I mean, that's not in and of itself not a problem, because I think most people, or a lot of people anyway, who are going to pick this issue up will not have read that previous issue. So it's not going to be any kind of a confusion point. I just thought it was kind of strange that, you know, they would have the end of the one setting something up that isn't going to pay off until, I don't know, like February or something, when the Guardians comes out. And, you know, we're just back to a standard Iron Man story. Now, this story I thought was okay. There are certainly going to be your people who despise Greg Land, and there's a lot of those people out there that I can't read a book drawn by Greg Land. I don't mind Greg Land's art. His women do tend to look very similar, especially his blondes. I mean, you get the blonde here on page 3 of the story, looks pretty much exactly like Sojourn. You know, that's his standard blonde woman that he draws. So, you know, there's a certain element of that to the story. The other thing I found kind of strange, you know, they've got these alternate reality or augmented reality or whatever. Reality. So I downloaded that onto my phone, and I hit these AR panels. I'm like, okay, let me see these things. And I thought they were pretty worthless myself. I mean, the augmented reality panels, a couple of them read the panel to you, and I was like, okay. And a couple of them showed a progression of pencils to inks to colored, some of them bizarrely zoomed in on just certain parts of the panel and kind of not the part of the panel I wanted to look at. And the thing that they mostly pointed out to me was how much the color actually detracted from this issue.
Really?
It's very dark in many places. I really think it, you know, some of the panels, it's far too muddy and too many effects, and, you know, this swirling pink, you know, behind Iron Man when he puts on his armor out of the suitcase in that one augmented reality panel in particular, just this black and gold armor is not doing it for me.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I mean, just in general, I thought it was an okay Iron Man issue. I gave it a 3 out of 5. I wasn't that particularly impressed by it. It was not something that I read this and it's like, wow, I must go out and buy more issues of Iron Man because this.
Interesting, interesting. In some ways, I felt the same as you. In some ways, not so much. I mean, you know, the fact that we just reviewed the final issue of the previous Iron Man series 2 weeks ago, and here we are already with the first issue of the new series. It's like, you know, that's really quick for them to jump back in. I mean, I didn't expect Iron Man to be out of play for any length of time, but, you know, I don't know, maybe have 3 weeks go by and then the new issue as if it was just the next month. The big thing that really got me was when we got to that third page, the one you're talking about with the blonde and stuff, wasn't the blonde. I mean, this is Greg Land art. I was expecting that. It was the way Tony Stark looked after so long of Tony Stark being modeled after Josh Holloway, the guy who played Sawyer on Lost. This Tony didn't look like Tony. It looked kind of wrong. I mean, I got used to it. It wasn't a big deal, but it just shows how when you've got an artist who's got a particular, you know, look for Tony and is able to run that for quite some time and, you know, have that be almost the definitive look in the Iron Man book and then to switch it, it just, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I see what you're saying, because I hadn't been really reading Iron Man for about the last year and a half, except for that last issue. So it wasn't that much of a shock to me, although it was funny that there was that one part where it kind of, the whole gag hinged off of, he shaved off his beard so he didn't look like Tony Stark. And it's like, well, he didn't kind of look like Tony Stark with the beard either. So,
well, you know? It's funny because I was going to mention that one. You know, like you said, he goes in disguise. And I'm sorry, at this point, Marvel no longer can mock the whole Superman, you know, disguised as Clark Kent using a pair of glasses bit after this issue. Because he goes into disguise by shaving what is referred to as the world's most famous mustache. And it's like, okay. And they mentioned, wow, I'm surprised this works, kind of a deal, but it's like, this guy, I mean, even over in the Batman books, they're using like a holographic mask or some such stuff here, and Tony's the kind of guy who could easily build that in his sleep, and they don't use something like that. I thought that was a little, kind of ludicrous. And then, you know, there's no mention explicitly of Tony having gone into space at the end of the last issue. I mean, it's been 14 whole days, so maybe they figure we've just forgotten about it or something. There's a mention of his vacation. And I know Greg Land's art is highly modeled. A lot of his characters are going to look alike. I mean, some of the things, images we've seen, particularly of the blonde, yeah, we could probably find other comics where we've seen very, very similar panels. You know, some people hate that. I really don't care. I mean, it's highly referenced, but it's good art generally. But in this issue, there are a couple of places it was not so good. If you go a couple of pages, two page flips before the staple, when we first hit Buenos Aires, Argentina, we've got that lady who's just standing around on the phone, on her cell phone. Her right arm looks like it's like dislocated or something odd. You know, it's like he had reference for the rest of it, but it's like, ooh, the model's not on the phone. I gotta go, you know, change it or something. Didn't quite pull it off.
Also, didn't particularly look like someone who'd just be standing around Buenos Aires. Maybe standing around Los Angeles or something. You know, it's like someone wearing very stylish, some blonde woman wearing very stylish clothes, just kind of standing around a darkened street that is
vacant.
Well, no, darkened because of the coloring, right? It doesn't, you know, and it looks to be about maybe 15 feet wide. This is the same problem that we had back when we were, at least I had.
I was going to point that out, yes.
That Kafu issue of Grifter, I think.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's just like a complete inability to draw a street that looks actually as wide as a street should be.
I'm willing to go with this could be a one-way street. The fact that it's completely barren other than this lady standing in the middle of the street on the phone just seemed a bit odd. You know, and there were a couple of places where the art just felt a little bit lifeless in this. I think Greg Land can be an amazing artist. The title Sojourn you mentioned, I loved that. I thought he did a great job there. You know, I think he's doing good work here, but not great work, not his best work.
You know what it is about Sojourn that it makes his artwork a lot better for me, I just realized? He does a fantasy book, and it's like, I don't have to say, you know what? That troll guy there doesn't look exactly like a troll guy should look. It's like you can make these fantasy things look as whatever you want, and if this woman's standing in the middle of some marketplace in Zagesh, I'm not going to look at it and say, gee, that street doesn't look big enough for a couple of cars to drive down, because, well, cars don't drive down some market street in some fantasy comic.
Well, you're not going to wonder if Zagesh has understreet sewers or not.
Yeah.
And I'll admit, I was wondering if Buenos Aires did.
You know, so I think he benefits from being in a world that it doesn't need to conform to what something is actually supposed to look like, because it can look like pretty much whatever he wants to draw.
Yeah, yeah. No, I would agree with that. And, you know, I think it's almost kind of the uncanny valley sort of a thing. It's not literally that case, because that deals with, you know, depictions of like humanoid things that are almost there but not quite and fall just into that uncomfortable zone. But it's the same sort of a thing here, where we've got enough of a frame of reference to be thinking, well, wait a sec, I've seen streets, I've seen people on phones in the middle of the night. I think somebody standing in the middle of the street, you know, not looking, you know, down it and stuff on a cell phone, oblivious and stuff, and somebody who doesn't look native to that part of the world, this seems a little odd.
Yeah. You know, and usually, no matter where you are, when someone's standing in a street talking on the phone, they're on the sidewalk. You know, they're not standing out in the middle of the street.
Yeah. And there's maybe other people on the street. You know, little things like that. The basic premise here is Tony and a bunch of his high-tech friends have been paranoid, and rightfully so, that their tech would go into the wrong hands and stuff. And that's what happens here with one of the things, and Tony has to go and save the day or whatever. You know, it's a decent start to the story. It's a decent start to the series. And the whole going after tech in the wrong hands is something of a staple in Iron Man. I mean, we've had the Iron Wars 5,000 or 6,000 times, I think. when his tech goes awry. So, you know, is that going to be how this thing goes forward? Don't know. But it was at least, you know, reasonable. The whole magic metal turning into the Iron Man suit. I don't know. I had mixed feelings on that, in so much as it kind of downplays the whole tinkering and armor and, you know, the forge and the building and all that stuff. And it just seemed like they wanted to give him a new suit, but not really spend any time giving him a new suit. And the other thing is this whole infiltration of the AIM thing. I mean, the whole shaving of the mustache aside, when it first kicks in, it almost, I thought it was just like a press conference or something. And I'm like, really? Aren't these guys known to be bad guys? I mean, don't people recognize those beekeeper outfits, the bright yellow and stuff from like the nightly news when they've, you know, torn up New York or something like that? And then it turned out to be a particularly exclusive auction. It's like, okay, Tony found out about that really quick, got invited really quick, and it's just how convenient. I think there was aspects of that where they wanted to have the guy doing the sales pitch kind of like they had in the last Iron Man movie, the Iron Man 2, with Hammer kind of doing his sales pitch for his stuff. So, I mean, I get trying to appeal to the movie audience and stuff, but I don't know. Still got some issues with the magic armor and stuff. We'll see how that goes. I like it when Tony's tech is more kind of tech-based than, you know, almost, I don't say nonsensical magic, but, you know.
I just didn't come away from this feeling, you know, kind of a wow, you know, Marvel now. I'm just it really jazzed up by this.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't strike me as a bold new start in a new era or anything like that. It was just, to me, another creative team change. Now, I think they've got a decent writer and a decent artist. I thought they told a good story. I thought it was well done and entertaining. And frankly, even with some of the things I pointed out, a little bit better than the average stuff. I mean, to me, this was a 4 out of 5, but it was not kind of that 5 out of 5 knock it out of the park that I was really hoping to get on a Marvel Now title. And I still think the Marvel Now banner and branding or whatever is, frankly, a little ludicrous. I'm hoping on some of the other titles they really, you know, knock my socks off. So far, they haven't.
Yeah, I mean, this to me, it was a 3 out of 5. It was an average comic. I was not blown away by it in any way. It was okay. And it was not good enough to get me to say, wow, I'm going to buy issue 2. Because I bought this one off the rack. It's not one of the Marvel Nows that I pre-ordered. And nothing here made me feel like I had to just rush out and add it to my pull list.
I guess for me, that's one of the defining differences between a 4 and a 5. A 4, I mean, I liked it, but it's not got the stuff I could say, but Bob, you really ought to get that next issue. A 5, it would have that. It would have me jazzed enough about this and have enough merits to it that I could be giving you a good sales pitch and convince you to get it. So to me, that's one of the things that's a dividing line between those two ratings for me. Again, I liked it. I think there's an audience for it, but I can also totally understand where it wasn't enough to pull you back to the second issue.
Yeah. So, you know, this one, just, it was there. You know, that was the thing with it, so.
Well, give it another year or two, we'll have a Marvel Next or a Marvel Now Again or some other ludicrous branding thing for the next set of relaunches.
Marvel? Yeah, I don't know.
You couldn't think of anything better, could you?
I couldn't think of anything better. Marvel Now! Well, in a couple of years, it'll be Marvel Then or something. I don't know. Ah, Marvel. You guys make me weep. Okay. Let's move on to our next book, 47 Ronin. Finally, a book I can get behind this week. I thought, so Mike Richardson, you know, he's telling this story that has been burning in his mind for years, and Stan Sakai is a great choice to tell it with him. One of the best known stories in Japanese history that I was personally not particularly familiar with. But, you know, it's a tale of the 47 Ronin and their years-long mission to avenge their disgraced master. It epitomizes the samurai code of honor, and it's often referred as Japan's national legend. They say, to know this story is to know Japan. This issue kind of sets up the point of conflict in the story, and it's very well done. I mean, you have the Lord going to who's at the Shogun's palace, right? And, you know, he's learning etiquette and all this. And, you know, it's really setting up the politics of the era. And I think the story is told in such a way that as I'm reading through the whole thing, I am just, I fall into the story. And at no point did I feel, wow, I don't know what's going on. I don't know why this is happening. I, you know, just like they told it in a way that even someone who's not completely steeped in Japanese folklore, I am able to, and legend and history and all that, I followed along with it just fine and enjoyed it from start to finish.
Interesting. So like you said, 47 Ronin, big thing in Japan, major legend there. It's also going to be a major motion picture starring Keanu Reeves, set for a December 25th, 2013 release.
Keanu Reeves, eh?
Yeah. And of course, that's not to say that this miniseries is being turned into that movie, but just that the legend of the 47 Ronin, that's the basis for this, is going to be the basis for that movie. And I mean, they've done a number of other movies, one in 1994, 1962, a two-part one in 1941, which is actually referenced in the text piece at the end, is one of the things that really inspired Mike Richardson on this. I have familiarity with aspects of Japanese culture and stuff. I know nothing about this legend, so this is a good introduction to it for me. And at first I was thinking, wow, you know, they're spending like 6 pages for this guy to really start telling the story that we're going to be reading. You know, and at first I'm thinking, well, okay, this is a little slow of a start. But I mean, really, it worked. And there were one or two places in there where, I mean, not only does it set the scene, but it sets the guy's feeling about, you know, his attitude towards the events, even though we don't know what those events are just yet. And they give us a couple of things like, you know, the terminology and a few things in those footnotes, which very unobtrusive, kind of the thing that doesn't really get in the way, doesn't, you know, shout out at you, but it's there when you need it. The one thing that I think worked less well than I would have liked to, I don't want to say it worked against the issue, but it certainly hampered my enjoyment of it a little, is everybody in this, for the most part, particularly once you get to the Shogun's palace and stuff like that, obviously are all in period piece attire. They also have the period piece hairstyle, which makes a lot of these guys look a lot alike. Sure, they're in some different color outfits and stuff, but there are a few places where I was getting a little confused as to, okay, is this the guy's assistant? Is this the guy who is this Asano or not? You know, and I mean, they've got different little, icons and stuff like that on their outfits, but sometimes those are either too similar or, I guess those are for the different houses or something or palaces they're from or whatever. It got a little confusing, and there are a few places where I was losing track of, okay, now which guy is this again? But with a period piece where everybody is gonna be in the same kinds of outfits, same kind of hairstyles, that's a really challenging thing to kind of, get around. And it's not like I have any particular suggestions that I think Stan Sakai could have done to really make that easier on me. And I'm not saying he's doing a bad job, but just that was something that I had issues with. Other than that, I really enjoyed the series or the issue and stuff. I thought it was a little bit of a slow start to the series, but it worked. And this is something that needed to set up what it set up, the way it set it up. So I don't think it was padded or anything of the sort. I'm really looking forward to the other 4 issues and seeing where it goes. I enjoyed this. I think Stan Sakai is a excellent choice for this. He's got the period piece stuff down. He's got the storytelling down. You know, it's great stuff, and I highly recommend it. The only real complaint I would have about this is that it's getting Usagi kind of on hiatus for a while. So, you know, I want to have both.
Yeah. So, you know, it was good. I liked it. Was a 4 out of 5. I mean,
yeah,
you know, a lot of the things that you pointed out, you know, fair enough. I think it kept it from being a 5 out of 5, but you know, overall, I thought it was very well done, and it's something that somebody can pick up and just get into. Did you read that text page at the back by Mike Richardson?
Yeah.
You know, I thought I liked the explanation. I think it kind of added a little bit.
Well, I'm particularly pointing out the movie he saw around the made during the World War II era and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So well done. A couple other number ones I read this week really briefly. I read Freelancers number 1 from Boom that I continue to applaud Boom for doing these $1 first issues that just make it real easy to try out new stuff. Where, you know, if they were $3.99, I would not really be trying out that many of these Boom number ones. And it really helps, because, you know, if I read it and I say, oh, that's really pretty cool, I think I'm going to start buying that series. And sometimes they miss. This one kind of missed for me. I read it and it was like, eh, it was okay. It's not something I feel compelled to come back for more. You got two female, I don't know what, bodyguards, adventurers,
it's,
bounty
it's
hunters.
Somewhere I would say between body doubles and executive assistants.
Yeah, that's a good, you know, it's kind of a combo of those two.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was okay, but I too did not feel compelled to come back. And I think part of the challenge is that was a dollar first issue. And the regular series is what, $3.99?
$3.99, yeah.
And, you know, for a buck, yeah, I'd probably come back for another one maybe, but, you know, they had the chance to really wow me on it and didn't. It was fine, it was good, but I'm getting, you know, 3-4 dozen titles or issues a week, so I'm being, I'm not gonna say uber selective about new stuff I add, but it's gotta have something that makes me think, yeah, it's worth adding to the list, and didn't quite make that cut.
I also read Colder number one from Dark Horse. It's by Paul Tobin and Juan Ferreira. You don't even want to look at the cover of this one. You know, it's like, that's the kind of thing where just seeing the cover of this book would set you off. So, be careful if you're in a comic book shop. I thought it was really good though. It was very creepy. You got this mystical guy who comes around. It's really hard to describe without spoiling things in it. But if you like kind of a horror comic, it's worth at least flipping through off the rack and seeing if you liked it. I thought it was pretty good. I give it a 4 out of 5. I'm gonna get that series now. I was trying out the first issue on that one. That one was a thumbs up for me.
Cool. Anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
That's it for this week.
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss The Suicide Squad number 14 from DC, Fantastic Four number 1 from Marvel, and Where is Jake Ellis number 1 from Image Comics.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.